I want you to know when I first saw the report, I thought, oh, well, if this is the yard, I'm out. And then somebody said, I guess it was Lisa, said, no. Need to go. It's 9:30.
I think so.
9:30.
Good turnout for a work session.
Are you ready, Carla?
Well, good morning,
by the way. It's great to see you.
Yeah, welcome back.
How was your holiday? Was your holiday fun?
It's a sort
family
of
thing? Yeah, okay. Well, we missed you. It's good to see you.
Commissioners, just so you know, I'm going to go through each of the individual recommendations and do a brief description, but leave time to discuss as we go.
As we go.
And then also leave time at the end for us to discuss broader.
So do you want me to chime in?
The first time you've worn a suit and tie.
All right, now you guys are cutting into my time.
Went to court that one.
So is this on?
Do you want me to chime in after
green
that
is on.
First
All right,
item?
Good morning,
wait.
Everybody.
Okay.
Is it on? Good. All right, good morning, everybody. This is the work session for, I don't even know what day it is. What day is it today?
January 9th.
The 9th. It's already the 9th. It is already January 9th, 2018. This is a work session. It is a very exciting work session. We're delighted to see everybody here today. It's on affordable arts space in Portland. I'd like to start by turning this over to Commissioner Fish.
Thank you, Mayor, and I want to welcome all of our distinguished guests who have filled chambers today. And ask you, before you go today, if you haven't already, please sign in with your contact information. That way we can make sure we have your current information as we do follow-up after this work session. Colleagues, I'm very pleased to co-host this work session with Commissioner Udaly and Mayor Wheeler. Today's topic is arts affordability, which is a shorthand we've developed to talk about the impact of rising rents on Portland's creative class. As we know, artists and arts organizations are often the first to take root in emerging and affordable neighborhoods. And they're often among the first to be priced out as those neighborhoods gentrify. Portland is one of the hottest real estate markets in the nation, and it's no surprise that the creative economy is feeling the squeeze. In the last few years, we've seen noted spaces from Town Storage to Troy Laundry to Jimmy Mack's close. And there will be more in the future unless we figure out ways to protect this important part of our culture, our economy, and our identity. The 24 recommendations you'll hear about today give us a lot to think about. They reflect best practices from sister cities and good ideas generated from community stakeholders. Significantly, most of them don't require any investment of general fund resources. Our ask today is to tell us is for you to tell us which of the 24 are worth pursuing further. Then, in the next month or so, we'll bring a resolution back to Council with a roadmap for future action. Again, colleagues and stakeholders, thank you for making time for this important discussion, and it's my pleasure to acknowledge and introduce Commissioner Chloe Udaly.
Thank you, Commissioner Fish. Well, I'll keep this brief because we have a wonderful presentation coming up, but I just want to say hello to everyone. It's rare that this many people show up for a work session. It's exciting to see you all here. It's also exciting to be having this conversation. It's an issue that has affected me personally, as well as many of friends and businesses and organizations that are very dear to me. And our arts and culture community are an essential part of our city. I can't imagine the city without you, and I frankly wouldn't want to live here. This is an alarm I've been trying to sound for a decade or longer, as I've seen artists and other creative businesses and organizations get priced out and pushed out of the city. So I'm really thrilled to be in a position to maybe help. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jamie Dunphy from Commissioner Fish's office, I believe.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, City Council members, Mayor, and Commissioner. For the record, my name is Jamie Dunphy. I'm a Senior Policy Director for Commissioner Nick Fish. Thank you for being here this morning. This is actually my first time presenting before you, and I'm glad it's my first time for something I consider so important to the future of Portland.
It's also, for those of you who follow these things, only the second time that Jamie's worn suit and tie.
With me this morning is Pollyann Faith Burge, to my left, with the Office of Commissioner Hugh Daly, and Lisa Taylor, with the Office of Mayor Wheeler. We're here this morning to discuss the future of Portland's creative economy and the ways that the City of Portland can ensure its long-term survival. Okay, there we go. Portland has always been known as a town where creativity is core. The understanding was that you could afford to live here working part-time as a barista, and since it rained 9 months a year, you had plenty of uninterrupted time inside to practice your chosen craft. Artists of all types called Portland home, and we gained a reputation for having one of the most vibrant art scenes in the country. It's what made Portland special. But we are perilously close to losing that identity. In many ways, we're a victim of our own success. We collectively made Portland a desirable and interesting place to be, so people have moved here in droves. The unfortunate byproduct of this mass migration is that we're now experiencing a citywide affordability crisis on all levels. The biggest indicator of this crisis has come in our housing market, which has seen real estate prices and rents skyrocket, forcing out many of the very people who made Portland desirable. The City Council has taken this challenge seriously and made unprecedented investments into trying to get people off the street and keep them in their homes. But our affordability crisis is not limited to home prices. Commercial real estate and rents have also skyrocketed. We've seen countless examples of historically affordable spaces being renovated or demolished to make way for office spaces and high-end condos that are out of the reach of their former occupants. Small businesses are feeling the crunch, and artists are increasingly finding it difficult to find affordable places to practice and perform their craft. For the past 2 years, Commissioner Fish and I have been working on a plan for how the City of Portland can effectively preserve and expand affordable creative space while recognizing that our biggest priority must remain getting people off the streets and keeping people in their homes. Last year, the offices of Commissioner Hugh Daly and Mayor Wheeler joined in our effort. We've met with dozens of local partners, artists, nonprofit leaders, developers, city bureau staff, and concerned citizens. We've met with our counterparts in other cities and read countless reports and recommendations from cities like Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Vancouver, BC, Denver, and Austin. And the culmination of this work sits before you in a report we've titled A Plan for Preserving and Expanding Affordable Art Space in Portland. I do wish I had come up with a shorter title. These 24 recommendations represent a Portland-sized approach to our problem, building off the best research and the best recommendations from the last decade into what works and what doesn't. We believe that these recommendations, if fully realized, represent our best opportunity to ensure the long-term survival of our creative economy.
Thanks, Jamie. Do you mind clicking it? Thanks, friend. Mm-hmm. And many thanks to the commissioners, mayor, esteemed colleagues, and beloved arts community who are in attendance. I see a lot of familiar faces behind me. I'm going to speak just a few minutes about the history of arts affordability advocacy here in the city. Jamie is right. We are not setting precedents with this potential resolution. We are learning from our sister cities to the north, south, and east about best practices. But Portland has also endeavored to this effort for decades now. First, if you look on the screen or at your slides there, is the image of the Arts Plan 2000, which sounds so futuristic, crafted in 1992. The clip art is hilarious if you get a chance to look at it. And this was the nation's first regional cultural planning process initiated in the 1990s by Bill Bullock, who was then the executive director. Is this spotty? Can you hear me? Oh, okay, there we go.
You're too close.
Too close, gotcha. Of the Metropolitan Arts Commission, which was RAC's predecessor. Among the accomplishments since that was adopted, MAC became RAC, an autonomous nonprofit arts service org for the TriMet region, and a portion of the hotel motel tax revenues was set aside to support the PCPA and other local cultural tourism efforts, as well as strategies were implemented to increase public and private sector giving, which is very similar to the plan we're looking at today. Looking over this decades-old document, we see some other things emerge that are still focusing on in our new effort. Thank you. Thank you so much. Arts education, arts affordability, and equity and inclusion. Fast forward to 2009. This second slide is an image of the Act for Art, the Creative Action Plan for the Portland Metro Region, which is another long title. And this probably looks very recognizable for several folks in the room, particularly for Commissioners Fritz and Fish. This was a document that really took arts advocacy from the philosophical lens to the fiduciary one, making a strong case for the economic impact that the creative sector has on our economic health of the region. This was also the main supportive piece that the Creative Advocacy Network, utilized in their work to get dedicated funding, public funding for arts education through what is now known as the arts tax. Boom. Lastly, with the success of CAN and other regional planning efforts, Mayor Adams embedded the arts in the Portland plan in 2011, and we are now embarking on this effort in 2018. Now I'll turn it back over to Jamie.
We began this process with a shared and clear set of values. This must never be an either-or conversation as it pertains to housing and homelessness. Getting people off the streets and protecting our most vulnerable residents must remain our top priority. But we can't also lose the soul of our city in the process. We looked for recommendations on ways we can inexpensively reuse existing resources, including public programs, public space, and public will, to expand and preserve creative spaces across the city. This isn't a proposal for a finite project. We aren't recommending that the city build a 50-story mega complex of art studios and performance spaces, though we'd certainly be open to it. These recommendations are meant to provide opportunities for creative reuse, targeted investment, and process improvements to help reduce costs, remove regulatory roadblocks, and provide long-term protections and incentives for arts groups, property owners, and arts-minded developers. We also recognize that the city cannot do this alone. And any effort to save our creative economy must be a collaborative effort between the public and private sectors. We can all do a lot more. Each of the recommendations in this report will require time, effort, and in a few cases, funding. They each have different levels of complexity, with some being ready to implement immediately, while others may take time to fully flesh out. However, we believe that all of these ideas are attainable. We've worked with a dynamite team of staff from city bureaus to help frame these ideas in a way to be most effective without compromising on any other city priority or program. While none of these individual recommendations will prove to be a silver bullet, we believe that collectively they represent our best opportunity to make real long-term change. Now, my intention this morning is to briefly touch on each of the recommendations, giving you the opportunity to ask questions as we go. We'll leave time at the end of the presentation for general discussion, and I'll make myself available to each of your offices for further refinement or any follow-up you may have. We have a shorter amount of time this morning, only 90 minutes, so we'll be going through this presentation with some expedience to leave you all time to ask questions and discuss. Because we're on a tight on time, I'll be trying to watch the clock and make sure we are able to get through everything, and I'll make myself available to each of you for any specific follow-up or recommendations you might have that we can't get to this morning. So, with your permission, I'd now like to walk through the recommendations in this report. Reestablishing the Arts Concierge Service. Now, the Bureau of Development Services would be creating a position specifically tasked with finding ways to reduce regulatory roadblocks, streamline services, and act as the city's single point of contact for arts groups and or developers that are working to create or preserve creative space. This position existed for many years. Ms. Suzanne Vara served the city in this capacity for many years. Her years of experience and in-depth knowledge of the city's permitting process provided an enormous benefit to developers and arts groups that needed an extra hand in ensuring that their projects were completed on time and on budget. This newly reinstated position will expand on the role that Ms. Vara championed and will be empowered to work across bureaus to look for ways to improve processes everywhere.
Colleagues, I have a little announcement. You may be aware, I have the Bureau of Development Services, and we have been actively working all year, of course, to make the process easier for everyone. But after talking to a number of community members and customers and taking the life of a permit tour, which was one of the more harrowing experiences of my tenure, I asked if we could add a concierge for small business organizations, artists, and they said yes, and in fact there was one. We had to cut the position during the recession, so we actually are in the process of fleshing out that new role, and we'll be listing it soon and bringing the position back to BDS. Yes.
Will it be permit-funded or general-funded?
Permit.
Well, we're 10 minutes into this presentation, and we already have one of our recommendations nailed down. That's good work.
Yeah, that one.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. Recommendation number two.
By the way, I do want to do a shout out to Ken Unkles, who is here and has done as much as really anybody to develop affordable art space in our community. And when I first met with him years ago, he was singing the praises of Ms. Vara, and just having someone at the Bureau that took his hand and walked through the gauntlet. And it's just terribly important that we restore that position and that institutional memory. And Commissioner Udaly, thank you very much for your leadership on that.
Absolutely. That's great. Recommendation number two is creating an inventory of our creative space. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we've met with our counterparts in other cities to understand how they addressed the threats to the creative economy. One common tool they used was mapping their creative space. Each city took a different approach, and each geared their inventory toward a different end. For example, in Seattle, they've created a website called Space Finder, where artists can search for affordable art studio space or performance spaces or community resources to help them further their careers. Others took a more documentary approach under the guiding principle that unless you know what you're trying to save, you won't. We have the technology, we have much of the information we already need, and this can be done in Portland. It's our hope that RAC, city bureaus, and council staff can collaborate to come up with common definitions and a common goal to help document our creative spaces.
Jamie, let me ask you a question on that. A couple of years ago, we had the Innovation Fund where people could submit applications for projects. This probably fit quite neatly within that. Now, under this mayor, we have money set aside every year for special appropriations, and that has a very broad set of criteria. Would you anticipate that any startup money for this particular mapping come out of that process, or would it be a specific ask that we would develop during the budget?
It certainly could come from one of the more creative pots of money that we have. I worked with my colleagues in Seattle and found out that to fully implement from scratch and maintain this for 3 years, the first 3 years, they cost about $25,000. For the following 3 years, it was about $4,000, for including staff time for maintenance and server space. So it's a relatively modest amount of money. RAC already has about, I would say, half of this information collected, and it's in sort of earlier versions available. So I think that there's a lot of opportunities for ways we can get this on its feet pretty quickly.
Thank you.
Certifying creative spaces. Now, this is an idea that we borrowed from our friends in Seattle. They created a certification for buildings, people, and areas that have a sort of seal of approval, recognizing the importance of certain organizations, spaces, or individuals towards the health of the greater creative economy. This designation would be helpful in giving protections and rights to those in the private sector that are helping fight the displacement of art organizations. This designation could help provide extra incentives for new development or extra protections against demolitions, or help create new partnerships with a common goal. Questions on that one? Number four, expanding opportunities for creative rooftop use. Now, the city already allows many different uses for rooftop spaces. We also have stated a set of priorities when it comes to what can be put on a roof and what must be put on a roof. For example, the Central City 2035 plan will be implementing the biggest requirements for eco-roofs in the country. However, there are still lots of existing rooftops that will have opportunities for creative uses. This recommendation asks the permitting bureaus collaborate to find ways to reduce many of the obstacles to creatively reusing these spaces while ensuring that our health, life, fire, safety requirements are met. This includes looking at stormwater and engineering triggers and aligning priorities and language to make this process as streamlined as possible. There are a number of examples where places where this has been successful and where it's proven to be a sticking point. For example, the renovation of the old Washington High School into Revolution Hall. Additionally, there have been a number of smaller businesses that have tried to do creative reuse on older buildings in Northwest, for example, that ran into some pretty significant engineering challenges.
So I want to just briefly comment on that.
I think that's a really important opportunity, and I think it contributes mightily to the livability, and I think it's great for economic prosperity as well. I think the most fun I've had in the last 2 years was probably my campaign kickoff, mm-hmm. at Revolution Hall on the rooftop, and everybody who came up there commented that you get a completely different perspective of the city and that it was really exciting, and everybody wanted to come back. The Society Hotel, I think, also demonstrated a really creative use of their rooftop. And as you know, it's not just about the views. It's also about opportunities to bring people together to share ideas. Many of us have been to in the Pearl District, Eco Trust.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. The Eco Trust roof. We've been to lectures there. We've been to performances there. We've been to speeches there, and it's just truly a fantastic community space. So I'm very supportive of figuring out how we can work this in tandem with our aggressive green roof strategy as well.
Absolutely. Thank you. Number five, exploring potential obstacles to the creation of new gallery space. Now, this is another idea we borrowed from our friends in Seattle. Portland has far too few galleries compared to how many artists who want to display their work. Artists have gotten creative, displaying in coffee shops, salons, clothing boutiques, and anywhere that has available wall space. There are some potential obstacles in certain zones that may limit the ability for galleries to be able to afford to operate. Some of the ways that standard retail establishments operate make it not cost-effective to operate a gallery. And we'll ask the newly created arts concierge to work with existing gallery owners and arts groups to explore any potential obstacles that can be removed.
Can I stop on that one for a moment?
Please.
Because there are some other recommendations later that relate to that.
Yeah.
Just a couple of thoughts. One is I think we have to avoid the situation of the moving boundary syndrome in terms of what our regulatory requirements are. And, you know, government tends to be reactive. So when there's a fire in Oakland, all of a sudden, nationally, people look at standards for things like sprinklers and other kinds of safety. And we don't always look at it in the context of cost benefit. We look at it, you know, immediately in terms of life safety, which is appropriate. But what are the unintended consequences of maybe going a little bit too far, and do we end up putting at risk spaces that are in the pipeline for affordable space? We're having a big discussion that the mayor is leading about unreinforced masonry buildings. And the question there is, how do we create incentives for folks that don't have the resources to do the work? Again, we don't want to unintentionally make it impossible to site some of these spaces. But the third thing, and we're going to get to this, I think, around 17 or later,
yes,
is, and Mayor, you know, we're doing a lot of redevelopment under your watch. And probably the biggest example is the post office site. And there is going to be a lag between, you know, when we take control of the post office site and the post office has been relocated and when the master planning gets implemented. My guess is that a lot of that existing space for a relatively low cost could be adapted to become artist space, where people just need a place to paint or sculpt or whatever, and we could create on an interim basis a use that would benefit, that would advance our goals under this report prior to any buildings being demolished or any major redevelopment. And I strongly encourage us to think about those interim uses, because that initial space for an artist may be what launches someone and then helps them, you know, on the way to getting a more permanent and sustainable space.
Yes. And we will be touching more on that in just a few minutes here. Absolutely. Perfect. Thank you, Commissioner. Number six, exploring options to incentivize creative space landlords. Now, we know with certainty that there are dozens, if not hundreds, of landlords or arts-minded landlords in this city that are renting space to arts groups for less than they could get on the open market. They do this because they want artists in their buildings and because they recognize the importance of this. This is the kind of goodwill that we would love for all property owners to exhibit. So we'd like to explore whether there are ways we can thank these landlords for voluntarily taking smaller rent checks. Could this be in a form of a credit on their business license tax? Could it be a waiver or a bonus for future development? We'd like to explore this idea further to ensure that we aren't subsidizing a market, but instead of thanking a willing participant, that it doesn't do serious damage to the city's general fund or that enforcement isn't too burdensome. number 7, live work. I'd first like to apologize to Fire Chief Nate Takara for my lack of creativity in finding a better term than this. This is one of those terms that gets applied to dozens of different things, but we mean it in a very narrow way. Artists looking for ways to reduce their costs so they can afford to pursue their crafts. And this means they often sleep where they work. Sometimes it means a converted garage or a basement apartment. Sometimes it means they're literally pulling out a cot in their work studio or storage space. What we want to do is focus less on finding ways to let artists sleep in their converted storage space, but more so, how can we come up with industry best practices to develop new, affordable, intentionally designed spaces where artists can safely live and work on their craft? We know that artists will find a way to pursue their craft, so we must find ways to ensure that the public is safe, artists are safe, and that our affordability crisis and insistence on safety standards don't drive folks to create spaces that are prone to literally blowing up, as we saw happen in Oakland, California.
Any questions so far? Okay. Number 8 is establishing a creative space definition within the mixed-use zone. This definition would be a less finished building standard for the commercial space within a mixed-use project. If we let developers build this commercial space to the equivalent of 4 walls and a drain in the floor, the cost per square foot to develop this space would be lower, and the developer could easily lease the space for less money. We'd need to build in protections to ensure that this isn't taken advantage of and ensure the long-term sustainability of these spaces. And number 9.
Before you move off of number please. 8, so Seattle has this program, and I'm curious, do we have any information on the success of that program?
Early. They only really started working on some of these things in the last year or so. So they have some early wins, but it's too early to tell.
Have they developed some estimates of what they think the actual cost reduction on a per-unit basis would be?
Not that I know of, no.
That would be helpful.
It would be interesting. And we want to flesh this one out a lot more.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Thank you.
Absolutely. Number 9, exempting creative space development from FAR and height limits. Now, I will readily admit that this idea could be the most controversial in this proposal. We internally went back and forth about how to create a system where developers would look at creative space as a bonus rather than a detraction from the larger development to pencil. City Council has been very intentional about limiting the number of FAR bonuses, focusing almost exclusively on adding affordable housing units. So we were hesitant to start exploring the idea of adding back anything else. The idea we came up with was to simply exempt these creative space developments entirely from the limits of existing FAR and height. This would, again, need to be carefully done so that these spaces aren't developed under the guise of being creative space, only to lose them a few years later. And certainly a developer could try and use this program to build a 1,000-foot-tall story of all affordable creative space. We highly doubt anything like that would happen, but an arts-minded developer might consider adding on a few extra rooms or maybe an extra floor to their development if all it cost them was materials.
Okay, just as a clarification,
please.
Are you actually saying no height limit, and as much FAR as they want?
Potentially. We wanted to explore it a little bit further with both the development community and with city planners.
Okay, we've just gone through 4 years of comprehensive plan, of the central city plan, which is mostly where FAR and height limits
right.
are, to decide what are, especially the height limits.
Absolutely.
So, and in the most... For the most part, buildings cannot get to the height limit without some kind of a bonus transfer, FAR, whatever.
Absolutely.
So the concept of saying that for certain businesses there's no height limit, I think is of great concern and will be of great concern to the community. And I just question, when we've had this comprehensive planning process, why would we then at the very end, or even before the very end,
sure.
say, except for this particular use, in which case all bets are off.
Absolutely.
Let me just offer a comment, if I could. These recommendations are a blend of readily achievable ideas in the short term, very provocative ideas that are unlikely to see the light of day. I think, and Commissioner Fritz, I appreciate that you're calling this one out in the context of Central City 2035 and our other work. The reason it's in here, though, is to provoke that discussion. It is not. None of these recommendations are baked in concrete, and some of them are frankly pie in the sky.
Sure.
But if we're going to showcase all the ideas that other places are at least exploring, we felt we should include it. And if it's the council's initial inclination that this one's a non-starter, then we have 23 others to review and to calibrate. But your response to this is precisely what we were hoping to get.
Absolutely.
Because these things are all, they all have a root in some other jurisdiction. And they may not be suited to Portland. And they may actually work at cross purposes with some things we've been doing. But if we don't put them on paper, we're not going to have this kind of opportunity to engage them.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm going to turn this over to Polly now.
Excellent. Okay. I have number 10, which is reconfiguring. Oh, I've got to be mindful not to get too close there. Reconfiguring the 2% for art program, which many of you are probably very familiar. As you know, when a public building is built or renovated, we dedicate 2% of the overall cost of the project to investing in art. Historically, the majority of the development like this has happened downtown. And as a result, our downtown is filled with interesting public art, to say the least. But folks in East County don't necessarily get to appreciate the benefits of that art. We suggest prioritizing placing art from the 2% for art program in areas around town that do not have as much public art, decoupling the art from the project. This has always been a discretionary opportunity. We would like to see it used more frequently. Additionally, we would like to consider the option to use these funds to go back into the project to create some permanently dedicated creative space within the building rather than the art itself. It's been correctly pointed out that the average dollar amount for the 2% for art program wouldn't buy much in terms of space, but as we all agree, every square foot counts in this effort. It might not be perfect, but it will be something. So number 11, you can see that piece there. Incorporate creative space into affordable housing projects. Using the previously described, quote, creative space designation, we believe it would be particularly interesting for developers for low-income housing to build creative spaces into their projects. The commercial space in these buildings have been historically difficult to lease to tenants other than convenience stores or, unfortunately, check-cashing businesses. Having a pottery studio, a dance troupe, or an arts nonprofit on the first floor of an affordable housing building would be a vast improvement. And I've put an image from Engage in Los Angeles, which is a housing project that focuses on older folks. And some of the stats from that has been really encouraging around how many people utilize the creative spaces rather than, like, say, a gym. So that's one example from Los Angeles. Number 12.
Can we stop there for a second?
Yeah, I'd like to.
Sure.
Mayor, this one has some really interesting synergies. So the Portland, Prosper Portland is, under your watch, looking at more globally at affordable commercial space. And they're looking at how to curate and monetize this incredible resource we have. I wish, and I've said this before, I wish 20 years ago I and maybe others had the foresight to see the commercial space in all of our affordable housing development as a community asset. We didn't, or some did, but we didn't. And as a result, we often left it to the nonprofit developer, which was perhaps the least qualified person in terms of expertise and skills, to sort of rent out the space, or in some instances, buy the space in order to finance the development. And what we lost was a inventory of interesting space throughout the city in both high opportunity areas and in emerging areas that could have been put to a public use. We could have slapped a land trust, some kind of commercial land trust around it. We could have done many things. You know, I do a lot of my eating these days vicariously, which means I watch the Food Channel a lot. And I was watching a show recently where the host was doing a tour of businesses in Paris, and the most famous manufacturer of hands in the world has the entire commercial space of the largest public housing development in Paris. So for that particular business, they had particular criteria for location, and they really didn't care who lived above. It had to do with access and the kind of space. And so the greatest hams in the world are being cured and manufactured and shipped in one of the largest public housing developments in France. I think it's a very interesting lesson about more creative opportunities for how to use the space. Because we're building in places that are now desirable, because we're building in high opportunity areas, the idea of putting some kind of art space, even on an interim basis, seems to be better than having for lease signs. And certainly in the long term is better than putting, I don't want to pick on anybody, but I think better than putting a fast food outlet or a sandwich place or whatever when we can do something that has a community benefit. So we see it as consonant with what Prosper Portland is doing around commercial space, and we hope we can bring commercial creative space into that conversation.
Yeah, I would agree with that. First of all, I did not expect to learn that about ham today. So I'm pleased, as always, to learn something I didn't know. I agree with you, and as Commissioner Fish just pointed out, obviously Prosper Portland is working on commercial affordability in addition to the efforts that the Housing Bureau is undertaking around housing affordability. One of the things that was going through my head, Jamie, is you were talking about the efforts that San Francisco has undertaken to actually do an inventory of their art space. The City of Portland and Prosper Portland own, operate, and lease a lot of commercial space, and I think it would be useful to undertake our own survey of our own underutilized resources, just as Commissioner Fish suggests. And I'm particularly attracted to the idea of interim usage as well. There are a lot of spaces that we all know that are both publicly owned and privately owned that sit vacant. We use them to good effect during the holidays for pop-up stores. Nonprofits participate in that effort, and they raise a lot of money in a relatively short period of time. And they don't take anything away from the commercial value of the space. In fact, they enhance it, because nobody wants an empty commercial space next to them, particularly a retail space, during the holidays. And I don't see why we couldn't take that same strategy and use it at all times of the year. I think it's a great idea, and I'll certainly raise that with Prosper Portland.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I just want to make sure that it's noted that Commissioner Fish has something against sandwiches.
something against sandwiches.
Sorry. I want to mention that I actually was able to visit three different developments in Los Angeles by Engage, the developer that Pollyann referenced. And they're really amazing communities. Two of the sites were for affordable housing for seniors, one with a focus on theater. They had a full theater in the building and a theater company that rented it out, but the residents also produced theater productions. There was a sign up when I was there that said warning nudity, so.
So you went right in.
That's where I'm going to retire. No. The second one we visited was focused on visual arts, and the third site was actually affordable housing for artists and for families with children in the arts, so mostly performing arts. And that building had a variety of maker spaces, recording studios. It was really exciting to see. I think those amenities raise the quality of life for the residents and create community and also achieve the goal of affordable housing for people in the arts. And the other thing I want to mention is I'm personally very interested in exploring the potential of commercial land trusts. I have had wonderful commercial landlords in the past, spent decades building a business and a community in a particular neighborhood, and circumstances change. People have to sell their property. People have to leverage their property to buy something else. The only way to really guarantee long-term affordability and stability, especially for arts organizations who will hopefully exist for decades to come, is if they have an ownership stake in their building. So I think that's something that I think we should seriously pursue.
Great.
Thank you all.
Thank you. So let's move on to number 12, requiring creative space in public buildings of a certain size. It's not every decade that we get a new library or a courthouse or we renovate an enormous building like the Portland building.
Thank God.
When we do, we have an opportunity to expand on our own development and intentionally build creative space into that project. If we're already building a new community center, we need to take advantage of that development to maximize our investment in our creative economy. Again, every square foot helps.
Would we? I appreciate this, as in the document, that there would be a discussion of priorities for that.
Absolutely.
Because obviously, if you're having to build into a community center extra space for a commercial space, the cost is going to be higher.
Absolutely.
And who would get it?
This
would be a question.
Exactly. This would be very narrowly defined, and we would work extensively with bureaus to come up with common sense of when sort of situations. It would not be every building. It would not be every time. It would not be every category of building. But where appropriate, I think there's an opportunity that we can definitely maximize our investment in this broader landscape without doing disservice to either the project or the city's budget.
Yeah, I think we'd also need to consider, is there already creative arts work happening?
Absolutely.
When we were looking at potentially having the Parks headquarters over by Gateway Discovery Park, we were looking at partnering with the Community Music Center,
right,
for example, to give them a space there.
Mm-hmm.
So I would hope that having that count would be part of the program in addition to simply
absolutely
commercial spaces.
Ideally, our inventory and map would be a good planning tool to help find where strategically to invest where to use our precious public dollars most wisely. Thank you, Commissioner.
Number 13, Artist in Residence Program. The Portland Archives is currently hosting an artist in residence that is creating new and interesting art based on the history of Portland. We have opportunities something like this in every public building. We know for certain that there are auditoriums, classrooms, meeting spaces, gyms, or even closets in our public facilities that aren't being used to their full extent. And this is maybe to your point too, Commissioner Fritz. If a community center or a firehouse or some other public building could instead rent an underused space for an artist for cheap, and exchange that artist got to teach a class or put on art and display, it would be a win for everyone.
I'd have to say, though, that our challenge is we don't have enough space for the stuff that we are already doing. So I certainly don't know of any underutilized spaces in parks buildings.
You know, this is sort of out of the box, but you know, when the public utilities replace old pipes, it's a treasure trove of source materials which could be used for some kind of sculpture. And, you know, we have in my office, for example, one of the earliest pipes that was made out of wood. And it's a work of art. It's just been hung on the wall. And if you look at it, it looks like a Lee Bonnecue or something. I mean, it's astonishing.
What I thought it was.
And it's just what we used to use to convey the water. If you think about all the surplus materials that we generate through replacing old pipes and fixtures, and think about is there a small space somewhere out near our warehouse where a sculptor could imagine using those raw materials to create something, I think that's in keeping with what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
And I think we could have lots of examples of that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Number 14, these two images might look kind of familiar to some folks, is the notion of art pods. So 20 years ago, the idea of buying ramen or a barbecue or a burrito out of a camper parked on the sidewalk would have been pretty unusual. But Portland, especially with rain in Portland, but Portland leaders recognized the opportunity that legalizing food carts had, and as a result, we have become internationally recognized as the food cart capital of the world. Let's do the same thing for arts. Many artists don't need a lot of space to create, display, or sell their art. A converted trailer or a camper would be perfect location for a painter, a mobile gallery, a sculptor, a designer, or any other artist. If done properly, the city could help streamline opportunities for artist pods in commercial and residential neighborhoods, just like we've done for food cart pods.
We are recommending that the city's permitting bureaus collaborate to find regulations that meet health, life, fire safety requirements and allow for accessible, local, flexible art spaces. These could be in parking lots, empty lots, or other creative places throughout our city, and we could even prioritize placing these types of facilities in city-owned spaces.
And Commissioner Fritz, to your earlier comment, or let me make a comment about this specifically, these would not be live workspaces. Just as most of our food cart pods are not hooked up to sewer and are not deemed safe to be living in, these would not be opportunities for that. We already have too many situations around the town where people are living out of unsafe conditions on our streets. We don't want to make that situation worse, and this isn't excusing or regulating unwanted behavior. This is being more intentional so that we don't have to have those sort of situations come up.
And as you move forward with this, I would encourage you to look at underutilized parking lots in particular, as it says in the report, yes, in outer neighborhoods.
Yes, absolutely.
Because certainly downtown, we want to get rid of the food park carts even, and get them developed into multi-use projects.
Absolutely.
I'm very concerned about the mention of parks,
yeah,
because parks are for everybody.
Sure.
And having an established space that is somebody's space in a park is very different from a food. We don't have food carts in parks, for example.
Right.
And so the mention of Waterfront Park and
sure,
other places, I don't think we should be giving over particular parts of parks permanently to private uses.
Sure. Well, just as an example, I live in Lentz. I know that there are a number of parks in my neighborhood that have some undesirable behavior happening pretty regularly. Illegal camping, illegal activities. We think this is an opportunity to activate certain areas as well. Just as the waterfront hosts the what is arguably the largest example of what art pod could be with the Saturday market, where artists have an opportunity to peddle their wares in a place and make a possibly undesirable area or possibly unsafe area more interesting to a community and more of an asset to the community. We want to activate these spaces in a positive way and look for a more holistic approach to how we do that rather than, you're right, this would be different than just putting a food truck in the middle of the park.
And
sure,
Saturday market comes and goes.
Absolutely.
So it's not, they don't own the space.
Correct.
And we have found that even with activation, mm-hmm, you're going to need rangers around.
Absolutely.
You're going to need various enforcement,
absolutely,
mechanisms. So I think, as I said, if we were to focus on areas like the Mikado,
sure,
absolutely, that sounds like a,
yeah,
great activation. And maybe there are parking lots near,
exactly,
those parks.
Exactly.
But for the parks themselves,
sure,
I'm just very...
have
said we're not going to set up tent cities in our parks.
Right.
We're not going to do affordable housing in our parks.
Absolutely.
And so I would encourage you to start with the less controversial areas.
Absolutely.
I love the idea of neighborhood artists and residents, though. I mean, I think of the city repair project and the intersection repair and the tiny libraries and the free boxes, and that'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not going to suggest that you each host an artist in residence in your driveway. I did not suggest that today.
Well, one of the things, Commissioner, that I like about the concept is making more transparent to the public the creative process. One of my favorite places in Lower Manhattan in Chelsea is a food emporium in an old building, and there are like bakeries where they have, instead of just having a blank wall, for privacy, they have glass. So as you're walking by, you can watch the creative process of how people bake and how craftspeople bake, you know, various goods. And the idea of having artists in the neighborhoods, in a place where, you know, families and kids and neighbors can stop by and track the progress of something that's going on, and the idea then that some of that art would then be showcased in the community and be a source of pride and a destination, I think is interesting. So...
Well, that just triggered a thought. You know, if we're going to do an inventory on spaces, we might want to create some kind of inventory or understanding of needs of different types of artists. You know, what are they looking for as far as square footage and amenities and, I don't know, ventilation,
right,
because it could be that we're just missing opportunities to match individuals with existing spaces that could be easily converted.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank
Great.
You.
Terrific. Great. Okay, moving on to number 15, real estate investment models. For many, though not all art organizations, the only long-term solution to guarantee an affordable art space is to own their own building. But few arts organizations can afford to purchase a building outright. There are wonderful examples from across the country where artists and arts organizations pool their money and their buying power to invest in a space. There are also examples where a private public organization that has been created that only invests in property development for the purpose of placing artists into long-term investments. Seattle's Equinox Development Unlimited, for example, was a byproduct of dozens of individual artists pooling their resources and purchasing the building they were already renting, giving each artist an ownership stake rather than simply paying rent. San Francisco's Community Arts Stabilization Trust raises private dollars from philanthropic groups to purchase property and then offers arts groups the opportunity to buy the building for below market rate. While there are not, where they may not be public money available to simply buy up land and sell it back cheaper, there are ways that the city can help create some sort of organization and provide some capacity and knowledge to do that here.
You know, Polly, in an interesting way, this became one of the more provocative and controversial ideas, if I'm just going off the social media, prior to this this work session. And it was framed in terms of, is the city doing enough to nurture public-private partnerships? Now, when we say public-private partnerships, it generally means we have skin in the game. So a classic example would be the Armory and under Mayor Katz. Obviously, a lot of the suggestions in this report, to the extent they are changes to our regulatory requirements and other kinds of things, are in fact public-private partnerships. They don't have a direct subsidy. They have an indirect subsidy. But there is this question, and it's something that we all ponder because everybody is approaching this from a different perspective. Not everyone has, like PICA does, an angel investor on their board so they can buy a building on Hancock. Not everybody has access to fantastic legal advice and a network of people like Northwest Dance Project to get around a regulatory hoop. Not everyone's going to have a champion like Vera Katz for one Armory project. And frankly, there are limits to what government can do, and I think we have to be we have to have some modesty about picking winners. And also, our general fund is very strapped right now. So we have to be very intentional. But this larger vision, it seems to me, is when you look at the ecosystem and we want all of these great institutions to prosper long term, what is our role in matching them up with investors, managing regulatory burdens? What's our role in terms of direct investment? Because from time to time, there may be something on a more modest scale. And on and on and on. And the goal is we want healthy, thriving organizations, and preferably long-term, we want them to own their own homes. And we're seeing a lot of nonprofits right now leverage this market boom to their advantage by selling their existing and planning a development somewhere else and an endowment that this market allows. How do we systematize that? Mayor, I think one of the opportunities that's within our reach is how we go about developing the ODOT blocks. The ODOT blocks create an enormous opportunity for economic development, affordable maker space, challenging the development community to come in with new partnerships and ideas. And I think that should be one of our real test cases for a number of these ideas, and we should be encouraging the development community to come in and reach for the stars. It may or may not be feasible, but we're going to learn a lot about which of these ideas has currency when we review those applications for the ODOT blocks.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if I could add to that, through Prosper Portland, we're already providing technical assistance both on the leasing side and on the commercial development side. Absolutely. And in preparing for This work session, I had the opportunity to raise questions about how intentional are we around arts space, performance space, and the like, and the answer is very. Yes. And Commissioner Fish rightly mentions the ODOT blocks as one potential intersection. I think it's a particularly good intersection because it also happens to be in an industrial neighborhood. And so the abutters to that property are intensely interested in what sort of commercial uses go in there. So the idea of makerspace, for example, is a center of target idea for that kind of development. I also want to get back to something you mentioned earlier, which was related to the role of the philanthropic and the nonprofit and the private sector. And in fact, there have been good examples here in Portland. I think about Falcon, for example, as being one obvious example of an arts-oriented private sector individual who happens to be in real estate, who just really is passionate about the arts and wanted to provide a low-cost, reasonable space for people to be able to do their thing, from writing to painting to whatever. My suspicion is our philanthropic pool doesn't run as deep in Portland as, say, Seattle or San Francisco. And so it would be interesting to me to know what you've learned in other cities as you've gone around. How did they actually leverage, not necessarily, let's say, the Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates of the world, but how did, or Google or whoever, but how did they leverage small business owners and operators, people who are regional heads of larger companies? How did they leverage that kind of support locally in their communities to help develop these kind of opportunities? That would be a real interest to me.
Absolutely. And we actually, that is recommendation number 24. We will chat on that in just a sec.
I have one thing to add to this item. I want to put a plug in for a homegrown opportunity, fairly new phenomenon called the Community Investment Trust, which is a financial inclusion tool developed by Mercy Corps, which would allow community members to become small investors in property and have a stake in it as far as what is done with it and ownership. I think we're seeing, you know, Wall Street investment firms crowdfund to buy up our real estate. There's no reason that we can't crowdfund right here and
absolutely
use it for our own purposes.
Absolutely. And, Commissioner, to your point, or Commissioner Fish, to your point about having skin in the game, we may not have dollar bills to push out the door, but as the mayor correctly said, we sit on a wealth of capacity and knowledge and technical expertise at Prosper. And additionally, the skin in the game that I see requiring a public-private partnership would especially play into number 16, which is what we're going to get to right here, which is...
No spoilers. And by the way, sometimes we'll just play matchmaker. I mean, there's been some reporting in the last week about the ART partnering with a developer to develop their site. You know, I haven't gone deep on this, but if developing the site creates an opportunity for a long-term home in a financially sustainable model, it seems to me that's the right kind of leverage. The question is how much of the art space is going to be retained and available to other groups. But that's no different than DePaul is doing right now, looking at their home and figuring out how they can leverage. So the question is, can a partnership with a developer preserve the affordable art space for some time and in addition meet some of our planning goals of density and building housing? To me, that's a win-win, and maybe our role outside of an urban renewal district is just to be facilitator, sure, is to be a matchmaker, is to help provide some technical assistance. I don't think, I have to go back, but I don't think ART is within an urban renewal district.
I don't know.
We'd have to change the boundaries.
Not certain.
But I think on the face of it, that's a very smart move to partner and have a long-term plan for sustainability.
Okay, we're going to move ahead.
Just a time check.
We've got 30 minutes left.
Yeah. Okay, great. Number 16, a city property disposition. So as
As you all know, when a city bureau has a piece of property that they no longer want or need, they offer that property to the rest of the city bureaus for purchase. When the bureaus decline, that property is sold on the open market. We believe that there's an opportunity to add an interim step where we offer arts organizations priority access to those properties before they are placed on the open market. We won't be offering any kind of sweetheart deals or selling it below market rate. We'd simply be offering them a cut in line. If no one shows interest in a certain amount of time, the rest of the process continues.